Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have another episode in the school mini series, and that, of course, is with Millie Carr. How are you, Millie?
Good, Jen. How are you?
I am really good. I have been talking about doing this episode with you for weeks, and we have finally gotten there. And this is such a big question that everybody asks, which is how to choose a school. Like, what are we looking for here? I'm super excited. If you haven't checked out Millie's other episodes in the school mini series, please go back. I'm going to put them in the related episodes. We are past halfway through of the mini series. We are nearly done. And this is an episode about how to choose a school that won't break you or your kid. So first off, Millie, first question, let's jump right in. Most parents are told to choose a school based on academic results, the NAP plan, or location. But do you think this is important for ADHD parents, and what should we be prioritizing when we are looking into schools?
Yeah, this is the number one question, especially when you're living somewhere and you have limited choice too sometimes at where you go to go. What school is going to be best? Is it best to find the public school, or is it best to go somewhere private? And I think it's really tricky sometimes. You have to definitely go to the school. I think personally, you have to go to the school and get a vibe from what they're saying. You have to be cautious of some certain buzzwords that teachers often use. In education, we have a lot of buzzwords. So people just saying things like, we've got an inclusive school, or it's student focused, that doesn't actually mean that it's actually going to be. And looking at NAP plan results doesn't show you that you're going to have a school that actually is going to suit your child that's neurodivergent. NAP plan scores often sometimes, if they're focused on that and they talk about only that, I would be very cautious about that, because that could mean that they're actually really trying to do things that might be actually harmful for our neurodivergent students, and actually getting them to sit down and do lots of work to actually memorize things to be able to do well in the NAP plan, and not focusing on their sensory and emotional and safety needs. So you might be having kids masking to get good results in the NAP plan, and they're abiding by the rules and expectations, but it doesn't mean that they're actually being catered for properly in terms of their actual holistically in terms of their needs. So it depends on what you find important. Some people look at NAP plan and go, oh, I want my child to succeed and do well, but NAP plan doesn't actually mean that you're going to do well in life. NAP plan is a score at one point in time. It doesn't even give you a whole picture of the child. That score to me means very little, and you don't even get to see the score until the end of the year. So they usually do the testing in around the start of the year. The NAP plan results don't come out until about October. It means nothing for the teachers either. They can't use that data to actually teach your child because they get it so late. It literally is just a score to allow the government to see, okay, that school's doing well in terms of their parameters are well, which is the scores, which academic scores we know is not the only thing that we care about for our students. So if you're thinking of NAP plan, and NAP plan is something that school is going on a lot about, I would be very cautious around that. What I would like to see and hear them saying instead is things like having safe environments, talking about the fact that they've got maybe their tier one support, so that the supports that schools have to put in place for absolutely everybody, that's not their extra separate interventions. Their tier one supports are inclusive. It thinks about sensory needs. It thinks about people being safety. There's talk of advocacy or student choice. It's trauma informed. These are the things that I'd like to hear from the school when you're going to have a bit of a walkthrough or an interview, because that's the stuff that actually is going to actually help your student. The NAP plan score, it's all lovely and well and good, but it's one score, one time. That student could have done really bad that day because they're really stressed about the test. Or they could have done really well that day because they've done, it's all based on just that day and that kind of need. So I would think less about scores and results and think more about what are they saying to make sure that your child is having a holistic experience at school that isn't just academic.
Okay, so I can hear what you're saying. We're not looking at necessary academic results, and the closest school might not be the best school. And we're being aware of some of those buzzwords, as you said, that people like to drop that may or may not, or that may mean completely nothing. So let's say we're going through school and they're dropping the buzzwords. Oh, we're very inclusive. Oh, yes, we've definitely got neurodivergent kids here. What would be some of the red flags that you might hear a school say? Because they're never going to come out and say, oh, no, we don't include everybody particularly. They're never going to say that straight up. They're always going to say the right thing. So what are some of the red flags we could see as we were touring a school? Even if it has a glossy kind of policy, they're saying some nice buzzwords, What are some red flags?
If I'm seeing things like posters in the classroom that have things about whole body listening or active listening, that's a massive red flag for me. If they have got that visibly in classrooms as you're walking through, and that's how they're operating with the students, we know that is a strategy that does not work for neurodivergent students a lot of the time. Everybody has different needs of how they listen, and teachers make this all the time at the start of the year, so you'll see them if you're going through the classrooms. They have posters at the start that say, this is how we listen, this is how we learn. I would look out for the visuals that you've got around the classroom, around the school. So often schools have whole school-wide policies as well that I look out for and be really cautious of. Things like, we make sure we look at the front. Resilient sometimes is a big word that goes around, you know, being resilient. Sometimes that word can be spread around a lot, but it's not always used in a way that, again, is neurodiversity affirming, because we're trying to get students to push through uncomfortable things. If you don't see any sensory supports around, if you go through and you see just desks and chairs and the same kind of environment in every single classroom, that's not going to obviously be conducive to good learning for everybody. You want to see some corners where there's some different kind of bean bags. There isn't a whole lot of visual stimuli that's going to actually distract everybody. You want to see that kind of stuff catered for and thought about from the get-go for every student. So you want to make sure the environment's being thought about really well. So if all those things, you're seeing little kind of things like that, but they're speaking this fabulous game, but you see something like that, we sit down on the floor and we cross our legs. If you're seeing things like that, that's a bit of a red flag that they're not actually doing what they're saying, because if they're doing those things in the classroom, that actually isn't. Even like reward charts and sticker charts, I'm really cautious of as well. So if you have things like we're earning a thing, we've got to put our stickers for sitting right on the floor or for doing certain things in the classroom, it's sometimes behavior that not everybody can follow and everyone can do. And that's not very inclusive. So we're trying to move away from those practices. And if your school's kind of got that going on, or there's a lot of that, you've got a few little bits and pieces, you can probably work with it. If there's lots of that and all the things I've mentioned are there, I'd be quite cautious about whether that school actually is inclusive.
I love that. I'm going to add one because I just, ADHD, have to say it. I got really duped in, particularly to that public school that I had that really awful experience with that wouldn't let my daughter go to the inclusion room. And they talked some amazing language to me straight up. But later on, when I ended up saying to them, I don't understand, when I joined this school, these are the things that you said to me. And interestingly enough, they actually said that all of those examples they used were only for children with physical disabilities. So when they're telling you about the accommodations and what they do, like, I think if they're using examples of physical disabilities, they may not believe in ADHD, neurodiversity, and helping kids that aren't physically disabled. Do you agree with that one?
I would actually ask that question, Jane. It's spot on. It's a really great point. I would actually ask, how do you cater to disability and invisible disability in your school? What are the things that you put in place for those students? If you can even go a step further and say, do you cater to students that don't have an actual diagnosis? Because that'll tell you all you need to know as well. Because as we know, we've had conversations previously, Jane, about the fact that you don't need diagnosis to have accommodations put in. So if a school says, oh no, they're for the students that are diagnosed, red flag. Because if they're saying that, then they're not actually really understanding what it's like to have, again, so it's the diagnosis. There can be problems and tricky things for parents to get that diagnosis and money and stuff. So they need to know that they've got to be able to cater to everybody. If you have them say, oh no, the beanbag, well, that sensory room, it's great, it looks fabulous, but it's only for the students that are diagnosed, red flag. Some schools really believe what they're saying too. They don't quite know themselves. That's a red flag. They actually aren't doing the right thing or actually don't know how to cater. So really great point, Jane. I love that.
Okay. So let's say you're going around on the school tour, and no one wants to be air quoting that mum. So there's always lots of things that you want to ask, but you don't. You also want your child to be accepted to that school if you're out of catchment or it's a private school, whatever it is that you're wanting to go into. You're not necessarily guaranteed entry unless it's your catchment school and it's down the road and you're going to get in regardless of what you ask. But you also want to ask some tough questions to make sure this is the right school. So what is the right way that we could phrase it? What are some good questions we can ask that would illustrate the point without kind of coming across too much or being too full on or making it sound like our child is a problem, maybe if we're moving school and we want to get into the school? It's so tricky to know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I feel like asking things like, what kind of sensory supports do you put in place for all the students? How do lessons run at the school? But you can ask really broad questions about, how do you cater to students that might need some extra accommodations? How do you cater to students that are working below how do you cater to students that are working above level? What things do you put in place? And they should have answers for these kind of questions because all schools are supposed to be catering to everybody. I think we could come up with some questions if you want, Jane, and maybe put them down for everyone, like some dot points that would be things that you could potentially ask. And I would be sticking to things like, how do you cater to these kind of things? What have you done in the past when you had a student like this? You don't want to come across like you're being that kind of parent, but something that you really want to ask, because you don't want to get to the school with all this flash buzzword stuff and then get in and you haven't asked these questions and they don't actually have a response and they don't actually have a solution, and then you've got to move and all the trouble that comes with that. So I think asking them, and sometimes actually being the parent that actually does say that. If it's a public school, like you said, they can't actually refuse entry. But if it is an independent school, you probably don't want to send your child there if they actually can't answer those questions anyway. If they're not willing to actually go forward and say, look, this is how we do it, and this is some examples that we've got of a student that's similar to your child, or I think also asking some of those specific things that you want to would actually be really important. I'm happy to come up with some questions, Jane, that we could like pop in the notes if you want, that everyone can look at and use to maybe take forward when they go do a school tour.
Yeah, I think that's great. So let's just say you probably don't need to ask every single question possible, because you need to look at the questions that are important to you and your child. So if you've got an internalizer, you need to ask different questions to a child who's hyperactive, jumping off everything. You might want to ask more questions around punishment, reward with a child that you believe might be kept in on detention, versus if you have the perfectionist, but they need a lot of anxiety support. Millie and I are going to go through some questions, but you don't have to ask every single question. We have changed schools 3 times, and the last time that we changed schools, the principal said to me she had never experienced such an intense tour, and that I actually was there for, I think it was around 4 hours, because I was like, I'm not moving my child again. This is it. Like, if she can't answer, I'm not coming here, because I know what it's like to move a child. When I started in the first public school, much nicer than what I ended up at the end. And at the end of it, when I said, okay, I'd like to enroll here, I did wonder if she'd even take us, because I thought, she probably thinks I'm going to be hard work. But I said to her in the moment in the tour, hey, I know that I'm asking you a lot of questions. If I can build trust with you, we won't have a problem moving forward. You'll probably never hear or see from me all term. But I have to make sure this is the right place for my child, because I can't move her again. So I think maybe starting off with a bit of a frame, if you've got a bit of a story, you've already moved, starting off with this is why I'm asking so many, as a bit of a softener.
Yeah, it's a great idea, I think, to make sure that they know where you're coming from and why you're asking so many questions. There's like a reason behind it, and you want to make sure that it's the right place for your child. It's a great point to start. Yeah.
And it's like less like an interrogation. It's more, look, I'm a really switched on mum and I love my child a lot, and I want to make sure that this is the right school for me and my child, but also that I'm not coming in with expectations that you can't meet. I want to make sure this is a great fit for everybody. So I think a nice pre-frame works. Let's say you're walking around, Millie, where would your head go if you want to do a couple of questions?
I'd firstly ask, what kind of behavior management? I don't like that word, but that's what schools use. So I would use that, probably be the easiest way to get them to understand what you're asking. What kind of behavior management strategies do they have in place at the school? So that's going to tell you what they do. So they'll talk about maybe their positive behavior plan. They might talk about they have rewards, or this will give you an idea of how they work with behavior. Do they have safety plans? Do they have engagement plans for students? So I would ask, what are their plans and what are their processes for behavior management? So a lot of the time it should be proactive preventative strategies that they should potentially talk to you. That's what the green flags would be. If they're talking just about rewards and following rewards, I would be quite cautious about that. And instead of rules, I'd be looking for them to talk about values. Students looking at values and working with values rather than students following school rules. There are school rules sometimes at a school, and the values show that the school's thinking in a little bit more of a less punitive way and a little bit more of a soft, gentle connection kind of way.
I think you've made a great point. So you're asking a question that's a little bit loaded, like thinking to yourself, I know that I'm looking for this answer, but you don't say that straight up. You ask the question really flat and just see what the response is. So you wouldn't start with, I disagreed with my child being kept in at detention, and then say, what's your behavior management? Because particularly if it's a private school and they're wanting the enrollment, they may tell you what you want to hear. So ask questions super straight without showing what you want the answer to be. I think that's a great point with behavior management.
It's quite broad. It was quite a broad question too. It could be, they could then go along their line of preventative, positive things they've got in place. So asking for their behavior management kind of strategy incorporates that positive stuff, but it also incorporates if something does happen, then what happens? Are they suspended? Are the school really like what counts? And then you can go deeper and ask some more questions depending on how they respond. If they respond in a way that you're like, yeah, this is what I'm looking for. I want it to be positive. I want it to talk about connection, values. I don't want it to be so punitive. If they go down that more punitive route, then you can start seeing that they're maybe going, okay, if they do this thing, no matter if they have a diagnosis or not, they're suspended. Do you mean if there's like a black rule for that? Then you'd go down that, I guess, depending on what they respond, then you'd go down two different like little routes of then further questions that you might ask.
And I think if you're getting a lot of general statements and you're not getting a lot of specifics, I would start to go specific. Like when they talk about supports that they're giving children, okay, nod and smile, yes, but also, okay, so when you say you have a teacher's aide, how many aides do you have per grade? Is it one? What hours do they work? How many classes do you have in that grade then? If you're looking at a school with two classes per grade, with two full-time aides, you were looking at a very small staff-child ratio, as opposed to a grade of eight classes with one part-time aide across eight classes, because then you're looking at a completely different ratio. So I think that's a great point. And if you're getting a lot of general fluff, go specific.
You can go more specific after you ask those more broader questions. So you can even ask that question, like you said, Jane. What is the school, how many education support aides do you have available to you? Do you have a lot of funding for that? And how does your funding work for that? Because every school does it differently too. Some people, there's one aide plopped in a classroom with four students that probably need it, but they're utilised for those whole four. And so that changes compared to one aide with one student only. It makes a difference with how the school view that and where they put their funding. So I would ask, do you have education support at this school and how does that work across? And they'll talk to you about, yeah, how they assign them and then their funding and how they're funding my work.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, cool. So we've done behavior management. We've done some staff student numbers. Where would we go after that?
My biggest one would be in terms of how do they set up the classrooms to make sure that students succeed? So how are they setting it up academically, the environment and the noise level? I'm thinking of all of the things that are set up from the get-go. So how are the classrooms set up from the start? And most schools start the year with a bit of a PD and talk to teachers about setting up their classrooms for that. So what I'm looking for there is, I guess, are they catering to universal design? Are they putting in supports that actually benefit everybody? Rather than just asking what adjustments do you have if my student has this, if my child has this, I want to know, are you setting it up so my child doesn't have difficulties in the first place? I want to try and eliminate some of the difficulties. And some of the examples I can give you, Jane, about that is, are students able to have choice in how they go about their task? Are they able to have choice and agency about how they respond to a task? Does everyone have to write a report, or can I choose to write a report? Or can I choose to make a poster or a video or a song? How am I responding to this task to get the knowledge out? And we know that everyone has different strengths and weaknesses and people can choose based on that. So I want to know, are you giving the students choice and agency in what they're doing? Are they setting up universal supports where there's visuals there of what the actual task is broken down for everyone at every lesson? I want to know that, because if they don't have that, the students that need that are going to really struggle. Yeah. And then if you don't know that's what they're needing, you may not know that they're actually pushing the table over because they're struggling to remember what task it is. So you go again down a punitive route of, oh my goodness, they're throwing things and then they're in trouble. But the problem just stems from just an initial thing that you could set up from the start. So universal design for learning is what I'm looking for. So I would be asking, what do they put in place at a tier one level? Schools and teachers know what this means. We have different tiers of support. Tier one is what everybody get. What does everybody get in the classroom to ensure that they are going to be successful? What are we putting in place for everybody? And the school should know that. They should know those things like visuals, how they respond to the task, how they present the task to everybody. Are they presenting it just verbally, or are they getting them to listen to things? There's so many different ways that you can present something. So what are they doing at a tier one level to ensure that everyone is actually able to access the learning and it's not just some few that actually can do it in that neurotypical kind of way?
Beautiful. Okay. That is a great tip across primary and high school. Is there anything else specific we should look for as a major one before we move on. We've gone behavior management, how they learn, accommodations, classroom. Is there anything else that would be a particularly big area?
I think I would like to know, I always ask if there are any allied health support that they're linked into for the school. I think it's a really good question because if they have allied health support linked in, even if the teachers aren't aware of specific things, they have support there to go to and help. At the school that I work at, we have two speech pathologists, one psych and an OT. And that's not probably as common in a lot of different schools, but that allows our school to have expertise. Teachers aren't experts in speech pathology, in sensory and OT needs, in psychologists in those areas. So we can go to someone who is a specialist to give us advice about specific students. They can run PDs. I think if you have them linked in as part of your school, that really helps. And it shows that they care about those things too. If you've got a school that's got no connection to any allied health, I would be a little bit concerned because I'd be like, how can you work with students the way we know students are today and the needs that we've got without having those things, those services linked in or someone hired in the school that actually is an allied health professional, which there are schools that do have and they prioritize that. But if some schools don't prioritize that and don't put their funding towards that, that again shows me that they're not really thinking about the whole, I guess, kind of child. So that's a good question, I would say.
One big question that I see comes up a lot in the Facebook group is around public versus private versus independent. And my personal, what I've come from, I've been in public and private and independent, is that it really comes down to the principal and how they use their funds. That's just what I've seen. So do you think it's worth asking where you put your funds? Because at the school that we've ended up, she puts basically all of her money into teachers' aides. So the ratio is smaller. What are some red flags and green flags in terms of the use of funding that you think we could see?
Yeah, I think if you're not prioritizing the teachers and how much staff you've got and the teachers' knowledge and professional development in areas that are really important, that's where you're going to get your biggest kind of bang for your buck, having aides and having teachers that know what's going on and know how to actually cater to your students. If you're spending money, your school's constantly upgrading buildings, basketball courts, because that costs money. That all costs funding and money. If you're spending it on all those physical kind of things, it doesn't matter how many beanbags, fidgets and basketball courts you've got, you're still not going to have a classroom that actually is really inclusive and really supportive to all students. So you've got to invest in teachers, and I would want them to be investing in programs that are backed by evidence-based well-being programs that are really good for staff and for students, because we know if staff and teachers' aides are doing really well, it's going to flow down to the students. If you've got teachers coming in and they're just a giant big stress and they're not being prioritized, then they're not going to do as much for your kids in the classroom because they're just overwhelmed and they're just stressed and they just can't. Your principal needs to be prioritizing the teachers and the teachers' aides and the numbers and the professional development they have. And if that's happening, it's going to flow down to the kids and it's actually going to create that really nice culture and environment in a school. So I think that's probably where hopefully they would answer, but not all principals would feel comfortable probably answering that question, I would imagine, just because it's a lot of different things that go into what funding that they receive, and teachers often cry poor about, oh, we don't have funding for that. But where is the funding actually coming from is a good kind of question for them to ask and make them think about. Even though they don't answer you properly, but it'll still make them think about, someone's asking, let me reevaluate where I am putting all of my funding. But yeah.
Okay, so what would be some other areas that we should look for to ask about or really listen carefully if it's brought up?
I would listen carefully if they're saying things like trauma-informed. So I know it's another buzzword, but it's a big buzzword that actually is really important, and it's going to ensure that our students are not going to leave school broken and with trauma. So trauma-informed stuff, and the things that I've got a bit of a resource that kind of shows a traditional approach and a trauma-informed approach. What you want to look for is things like them knowing that behavior is communication, talking about dysregulation as being a stress response, all the things that we know we've been talking about, things like co-regulation. We want them to talk about safe environments. We can't learn unless we have that. Relationships and having that relationship part at the forefront before academics. Predictable, safe environments, thinking about internal motivation when we're thinking about their actual like work and not thinking about making it just academic stuff. It's thinking about them being excited about the learning and catering it to their different interests. The fact that one that I like the best is them knowing that equity in comparison to equality. Equality is that everyone gets the same thing, and you don't want a school that actually does that. We want equity where everyone gets what they need, and that's a trauma-informed approach. So if they're doing these kind of things, and if they mention trauma-informed, I would go, oh, what does that mean? These are the things that you want to hear them say. Things like safe regulation, thinking about the brain, thinking about our nervous system, planning things like brain breaks and positive primers and things in to make it really positive, fun, exciting experience for students to be at school. If we don't have those things in place and you don't have those predictable, safe, fun routines, kids don't want to go. And it's very obvious when you don't have those things in place because students don't want to go to school and students start not liking school when you have those things in place. So trauma-informed would be another kind of one that I would look out for. Or you could ask that question, are you trauma-informed? How are you trauma-informed? Because if you have those things at school, it's going to ensure that the students are not going to leave the school with trauma from having to mask and conform to these kind of compliance-based things that we're used to in school. We don't want to see that anymore. We want to move away from compliance-based and make it connection-based and safe and relationships. And that is the focus of school.
Okay, I love that. I'm going to add another one as well. I see so many mums not check out the local Facebook groups. If I was seriously considering a school, I would go into as many local Facebook groups as possible and search the school's name, search the acronym. Yes, you can post and ask the question, but I think depending on the day, you can get different answers. If you want to look at trends and you want to look at some horror stories, some really good things, recommendations, I reckon search the Facebook groups all the way back the last couple of years. People will really tell you. And I've noticed as well, if you say, can you send me a PM? People will PM you.
I was going to just say, Jen, I was going to add that to you. Sometimes when you post, people are scared to actually say something or give their story completely on like a thread. But if you were to say, please message me privately, I feel like that's where you will get, yeah, the proper story of actually what's going on and what experience they've actually had. Yeah.
And I think putting there particularly what it is that you're looking for. Do you have a internalizing child? Because then otherwise you're going to get responses from neurotypical parents who think it's great. You're going to get otherwise. What are you particularly looking for? Do it anonymously if you have to, and then try and get some information back that way. Because then later on you might hear, oh yeah, we all knew that they had a really bad bullying policy. I didn't know that because they told me they had a great policy. Mm-hmm. Asking those questions I think is important as well. Do you have anything more before we finish up in terms of what we would ask on a school tour?
This is something that I really like to ask is in terms of like outside play, we know that playtime, snack and lunch is like a massive problem sometimes for our students that are neurodivergent. They don't know how to play with friends. They have issues with friends. What do they do for those students outside when it's lunch and playtime? Do they just send them out there? What do they do to prepare them? What do they do to help cater to students that are struggling? Do they have any programs, supports, clubs? What do they do for lunch and snack time? Because we have to think about that as a school because we know that there's going to be issues and there always is issues. How can we avoid them and actually make sure that our students feel safe and happy to go outside at lunch and have somewhere to go that they feel good about? So what do they have in place for that? Have they thought about that at all? Because hopefully they have. And if they haven't, that's, again, another bit of a red flag, I think. That's one more I reckon I would add.
Yeah, I love that. Okay, that's great. We're going to put together a little bit of a resource and some questions that you can put together. I think that's been great. And I have very rarely heard someone speak specifically around what to ask. There's a lot of general episodes, general information, but I think specifically what to ask when you get there, particularly the ADHD mum community wants to know, specifically, what do I ask? Yes, I should check about the inclusion policy. So they say, what's the inclusion policy? They say some buzzwords, you think done, and we can get caught out. So I think specifically, you've really mentioned some great questions. So I really appreciate your time, Millie.
No worries at all, Jane. I love it.
Okay. So if you'd like to check out more about Millie, I've got all of the information in the show notes. Go back into the school series. We've got her other episodes. And we've also got a couple more to go. Please check her out or check her out on Instagram. Her website's going to be there as well. But until next week, Millie, thank you very much for your time.
See you later, Jane. Bye.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD mum's shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.